Should you be using antibacterial soaps to wash your hands?
Are we wasting money on multivitamins?
Changing guidelines for another very common medical condition, that's high blood pressure.
And the interaction between calcium channel blockers and antibiotics.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on December 20th, 2013. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas in San Antonio.
Rick, why don't we start with one of the stories this week that got huge media attention. That was the FDA's decision to scrutinize antibacterial soaps.
So, Elizabeth, this is one of the rare times where we're not talking about a study, but instead we're talking about the absence of a study. Why don't you take it from there?
Well, as we know, there are these soaps that are out there being vended not just to hospitals, which is where they started with this whole process, but to consumers as well, that are touted as being better at removing bacteria from one's hands and from other things. And we know, of course, that that's a very effective strategy for reducing infection. But oops, looks like maybe some of the stuff that's in some of these soaps might not be the best exposure.
What you're saying is that hand washing is effective, but there's no evidence that hand washing with these soaps that claim to be antibacterial are any better than just routine soap.
Right, and they could be dangerous. That's right.
Well, that's exactly what the FDA is concerned about as well. First of all, I need to make sure that our listeners understand this only covers consumer antibacterial soaps, and it doesn't apply to the hand sanitizers or the hand wipes or the antibacterial soaps that are used in the hospital. We're talking about soaps advertised as antibacterial. And as you suggested, some of them contain two substances, one called triclosan, one called triclocarban, which may be serious in terms of causing unnecessary health risk. They may interfere with hormones, may affect growth of young children. One of these may actually contribute to antibiotic resistance as well.
Of course, we know, as I suggested, that these things were originally developed for use in hospitals. But even in that application, they were never subjected to rigorous scrutiny or study to see whether these particular ingredients were troublesome.
So the FDA is telling the companies that manufacture these, you have a year to get us data. And we're looking at not just does it inhibit bacterial growth in a petri dish or in a cell culture, but is there any evidence that it actually decreases the risk of clinical infections? We'll know in a year. But right now, many hospitals have stopped using these soaps because of the health concerns we've talked about.
Would you agree with the idea then that if consumers have those things lurking about at home or if they still find them on the shelves someplace that they ought to select other types of soaps and just go ahead and just wash your hands? We used to do this public service announcement that said, wash your hands as long as it takes you to sing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. And that's pretty good at reducing bacterial load.
Well, Elizabeth, you'd never want to hear me sing anything, let alone Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, but I agree with you. Washing your hands is the most important thing for lowering the risk of infection, and I would tell our consumers to avoid soaps that have the antibacterial labeling until we find out whether they're more effective and whether they're safe.
All right, well, I'm going to take you up on that lack of singing there, but perhaps you could just hum along. Let's turn now to another sacred cow, and that is this issue of multivitamins. We have, of course, talked a lot about the different vitamins and minerals and supplements that are out there, and gosh, every single time it appears that we pan them, now we're panning the multis. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
And there were actually three studies that appeared in the Annals that talk about the use of multivitamins. The first was a systematic review of trials that updated the USPSTF recommendations. And what they did is they reviewed three trials of multivitamins and about 24 trials of single or paired vitamins in over 40,000 individuals. And what they discovered is that in the routine population, there was no clear evidence that these multivitamins or supplements reduce mortality, reduce cardiovascular disease, or cancer. The other two studies, one looked at the use of multivitamins in almost 6,000 people and their use to prevent cognitive decline. There was no difference between the multivitamins and placebo in overall cognitive performance or in verbal memory. And the last study looked at people that had heart disease. And they used, in this study, a very high-dose 28-component multivitamin supplement in 1,708 men and women that had a previous heart attack. The patients that took multivitamins did not have a better outcome as opposed to those that had placebo.
Once again, of course, we have a colleague who's fond of asserting that multivitamin supplements, and in fact, many of these supplements merely give people very expensive pee. Besides that, some of them are fat soluble, of course, and so the body stores them. So there could be some dangers inherent in dosing over long periods of time with some of these vitamins.
Yep. And for many patients and for physicians as well, they say, well, they're just vitamins. They can't possibly be harmful. So go ahead and take them. But in fact, we know that some of the vitamins are harmful. We spend about $28 billion annually in the United States on these multivitamins and supplements.
So it sounds like something that we need to give a miss.
So no benefit and potentially harm. Let's get rid of them.
Okay. Talking about getting rid of things, let's turn then to the 8th Joint National Committee on Hypertension. They've decided that, okay, for a lot of people, we could probably get rid of antihypertensive or blood pressure medications because we're going to increase the numbers at which we're going to treat.
As you mentioned, the Joint National Committee makes recommendations based upon all the available current evidence about how we should treat people with hypertension, what's the goal, and what agents we should use. This update was done in 2003, so this has been a much anticipated update. They made 9 recommendations based upon the review of the literature. For individuals over the age of 60, you treat their high blood pressure if it's over 150 over 90. The goal is to get it below 150 over 90 and not any lower. If you're under the age of 60, the target is to get the blood pressure under 140 over 90. By the way, that's no different even if someone has diabetes. Now, what about the particular agents? They're now recommending for the non-black population, the first-line choice include either a thiazide diuretic, a calcium channel blocker, an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor, or an angiotensin receptor blocker. And in the black population, they're recommending either a thiazide diuretic or a calcium channel blocker.
Gosh, I just have so many things to say about this. It's hard to know where to begin. First of all, boy, this is just like those cholesterol things with LDL. Changing the quantitative basis of when we treat and what the targets are, this is going to require a massive re-education effort.
It does. It's one thing to print guidelines. It's another thing to put it into clinical practice. And that's sometimes the disconnect.
Well, the other thing I would have to say about this, too, is something that we've been observing for a few years now. Gosh, there's a natural history that's related to aging that we really need to develop a better understanding of. We know that people's blood sugar changes. We know that lots of other things change. And so this idea that we don't need to treat hypertension until the systolic and diastolic pressure are higher, actually, in my mind, is a recognition of that fact that as we age, our blood vessels become stiffer and therefore our blood pressure is going to be higher.
Not only is it higher, but there's an additional risk or harm to the patient if we get too aggressive with lowering the blood pressure, and that is we cause hypotension and or strokes. Elizabeth, I agree with you. These recommendations do give credence to the fact that older individuals, their hypertension, their blood vessels are different than younger individuals.
I think we're going to be seeing a whole lot more of that as many of us are aging. That would be you, of course, not me. Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Speaking of all these medications and their interactions, in this case, calcium channel blockers, clarithromycin, and acute kidney injury.
These are both commonly prescribed drugs. Calcium channel blockers are metabolized by a particular enzyme that is inhibited by clarithromycin. So what this study did was it looked at a population-based retrospective cohort study in Ontario to see whether the use of calcium channel blockers with clarithromycin was associated with an increased risk of hypotension, low blood pressure requiring hospitalization, and hospitalization resulting from acute kidney injury. And they compared that to calcium channel blockers with a different antibiotic. And what they found was that the combination of a calcium channel blocker and clarithromycin doubled the risk that individuals would have acute kidney injury, and it also increased the risk of all-cause mortality by about 70%. The absolute risk is pretty small, but this still means that hundreds of individuals either develop acute kidney injury, hypotension, or died as a result of this drug-drug interaction.
And clearly an important thing to identify. There certainly are alternatives to clarithromycin.
And that's exactly the point that the authors make.
These are the kind of things that, of course, we discern with these robust databases and that turn out to be really beneficial for lots of people.
And my hat's off to the Canadians because we're able to use Ontario's healthcare databases, and that's why they're able to do this study. If we're going to talk about Canadians, again, we're going to acknowledge our faithful listener, Tom, the veterinarian, who has his veterinary students listen to our podcast as well.
poor things, really. Hi, Tom, and all of Tom's students. I'm going to reveal that this week I'm going to talk about the antibacterial soaps on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.